Has tennis always been a metaphor for fucking? My name is Jason. I am the last manager of the last video store in the universe. When I'm not busy managing that store, I go to the movie theater and I watch movies. I leave the movie theater and then I talk about them on the internet for nerds. Because I'm one too. Movie nerds, rejoice! Binge Movies is almost back. The draft is almost here for the next round for season 8.2. Had some delays due to health concerns. So it's not imminent, but it's not imminent. It's not emesis either. All right, so I've got three movies I'm going to talk to you about here. Spoiler-free and then spoiler-filled a little bit from what I can remember for our patrons over at patreon.com/bingemovies. If you want these instant reactions even more instantaneously and perhaps extended, and be like Bob and join patreon.com/bingemovies, and you can get that very thing that you want. Isn't it funny how just life works out like that? All right, let's start with a French horror film called Infested, which is currently available worldwide, I think, on the Shudder app. I think it came out last year in France, if I'm not mistaken. Just making its way globally now. Infested. What can I say about this one? This is like Arachnophobia meets Meet the Block, sort of. Not as funny. Young man who's living in, I'm not sure if it's government housing, but it's definitely low income housing in France, is a collector of sorts, and a seller of things that people collect to try to hustle and make money and this sort of thing. And he comes in the possession of some mythical spider from, I think, the Middle East. I don't remember if it's said where it was at, but it's in some desert spider. And he comes into possession of it, even though the spiders are, this particular breed of spider is exceptionally deadly. He's sort of vaguely aware of that, but not to the full extent, and neither are we. And then that spider gets loosened to this low-income apartment and begins to rapidly multiply. This happens while one of his childhood friends and his sister and his childhood friend's girlfriend and a friend of a friend. And basically there's this group of people in their 20s, early to mid-20s. They all have different relationships with each other, which get sort of unpacked throughout the course of the film. There's definitely tensions. And our man, the main character here, is completely and entirely like outside. He's an idiot, and he is sort of at fault for everything that happens, because he's just not a responsible person. I wouldn't say he doesn't mean well. Part of the context is this brother and sister duo. He wants to hold on to what they have because their mother had semi-recently passed away, and he just has not been able to really get over it. And the sister has seemingly moved on with her life, to the point that the brother questions whether or not she even ever cared about the mother, about the life that they used to have. And really what he's asking is, do you even care about me? Because they are daggers for each other. And the spider, it starts off as one spider that's really, really small, and it quickly becomes a nest of spiders that are slightly bigger. And essentially each time this species of spider reproduces, it reproduces as a more efficient killing machine. So it's the idea of natural selection, but kind of on quantum speed. And that's where it gets into the more of the horror, almost like sci-fi sort of elements, because that's not really plausible. You know, Arachnophobia, at the very least, tried to give you a logic. This is this undiscovered species, kind of like here. And it's come to the United States, and it has it's mated with indigenous spiders, which has created this hybrid the world's never known before. And it doesn't really, you know, it's over a long course of time. This is over a day or maybe a couple of days. It's really hard to tell because they're so locked into this low-income housing that we lose sense of time and place, and it's very dark, and there's power outages. And the movie is essentially, after maybe about the first 30, 35 minutes, it is a series of set pieces. It's a series of set pieces to make your skin crawl and to make you scream at the screen to the characters, don't you fucking do that. And at the same time, the movie is sometimes in a very clever way sort of forcing the hands of the characters, because even they, again, occasionally are acknowledging, man, we shouldn't be doing this. Like, this isn't going to work. Like, this is dangerous. We shouldn't go into that room. We shouldn't do this. We shouldn't go down this hallway. And something happens in the movie that leaves them no other choice but to go around the corner and further into danger. And that's the best way to describe the movie. And so I would say it's a horror film in the sense that there is body horror. There are spiders that are crawling out of every creak and crevice of the building and the human beings therein. These spiders begin to nest inside of people and in people's wounds and in their brains. And it gets pretty gnarly. And the spiders are, I think the little ones, maybe all of them actually are all digital, the low lighting helps conceal that. And this movie has to have some kind of budget to it, because towards the end of the movie, the scale gets just a little bit bigger. No pun intended, if you've seen the movie. And some of those effects actually look really well done. So, but it helps that the spiders move very fast and they're very quick. And it's almost sort of like, if you can imagine being trapped in a low, like a tenement housing with facehuggers popping out of every corner, that's kind of what's going on, right? And then it's getting on people, and they're venomous, and the poison very quickly, but painfully, not quickly enough perhaps, fucks you up. And essentially every time you kill one or a next generation emerges, and again, they're reproducing very, very quickly. They get bigger and they get smarter. And I think most of the logic of it holds up pretty well, which is always the question of a creature feature in a horror movie. The character work is really done very well. The acting's pretty good, at least from, it is subtitled. It's all in French. There's some real levity to the movie too. Like, there's a lot of comedic beats and comedic timing in the way that certain characters do and say things. There's a certain believability in how the characters are kind of dumb, but they're not dumb in an insulting way. They're dumb in the way that people are dumb, and they're dumb in the way that people are dumb when we panic. So all in all, it's like a really, if you like kind of all in one night, we're trapped in a particular place. It's very similar in essence. This is ironic to the most recent, like Evil Dead Rise. The director of this film is the one who's been tapped to direct the next Evil Dead installment. And I think this bodes well for, he's got the chops to be able to do confined horror, body horror, this kind of thing. There's this really, really great shot in particular. I don't want to ruin it, but it's this sort of swirling 360 shot down a corridor, and it's really exceptionally well done. And I could definitely see the muscularity, and we'll get to another movie very quickly that's also sort of very muscular in its direction. I really like this one. I think of the two recent Shudder exclusives, I might like this one equal to, maybe a little bit more than Late Night with the Devil. I'd be more than happy to discuss that with you if you want me to at a later time. I like Late Night with the Devil, but this one feels like a whole movie. So it's a really solid creature feature. I if you have Shudder, it's definitely worth a check out. It might be on VOD elsewhere. I might be a Shudder exclusive, I'm not sure. But if you already have Shudder, you're already paying for it, this is a great one to fire up, especially on a late, late Saturday night. I will say, if you're terrified of spiders, this movie will fuck you up, so don't watch it. All right, moving on to our next film, which I did not like so much. I think I'm in the minority. It is the new Bill Skarsgård film. I think it's Bill. Isn't this one Bill? Boy Kills World. Boy Kills World is something on paper that I should really like. And I had low to medium low expectations for the film. I would say medium low to medium is probably better. In expectations in the sense of this could work for me. I will say this. I think that I am about John Wick'd out. This isn't exactly John Wick. And obviously, you know, in essence, it kind of has more in common with The Raid, and it stars as the shaman, one of the actors from The Raid. But I'm kind of tired of it. I'm at this sort of ultra-violent, fast-moving, super martial arts assassin movie, Hollywood movie star turned super assassin. Because whether it's Bullet Train or Boy Kills World or Atomic Milkshake, what was that? Gunpowder Milkshake. Well, that one wasn't horrible. It's, you know, Atomic Blonde. You know, the ballerina, maybe, like all of these things that have sort of rode the coattails of things like The Raid and the first John Wick. Those types of movies are way harder to make than you think they are. They're hard. Okay, so how do I put this? The style is really hard to come by, because if you have an extraordinarily stylistic film, but it doesn't quite come together on the screenplay level, then what you end up with is a gimmick and potentially a series of gimmicks. And if the action sequences, action isn't great because it's long, and it isn't good because it's bloody, right? You look at a lot of the, and obviously I'm talking about some of the top action ever, but you look at a lot of the Hong Kong movies of the 80s, the good ones, right? The heroic bloodshed movies or the kung fu movies or just straight up kung fu movies. There isn't always like a ton of blood. Like there's not a ton of blood in Super Cop, but the action is it's rendered so creatively that your jaw drops. You're even though it's kind of goofy and it's, you know, it has comedy elements and melodrama elements and all this other shit, it doesn't always like blend tonally very well. The movie still comes together because you know for a fact that you're watching some of the coolest stunt work that's ever been done in the history of film. And you know that. You have a respect for it. Just having long, chaotic sequences where the camera either for real or digitally is made to be like it's almost on a zip line or on a drone that's spiraling out of control doesn't make the action interesting. And there was so many repetitive hand-to-hand combat scenes where this guy, the boy, played by Skarsgård, who is seeking revenge for the people who killed his mother and his sister, who has been raised in the jungle by a shaman who is deaf and has had part of his tongue removed, so he is both deaf and mute, at least partially deaf. He doesn't speak, but he has this wall-to-wall voiceover. It just narrates every breath of this movie, save maybe the last 30 minutes. And I'll come back to that. And he lives in a dystopian future, and there's this thing called the Cully, which is basically kind of the Hunger Games, but it is mass execution of the public enemies and political rivals of the Vanderburg or Vanderhilt, or whatever the fuck they are. The Illuminati who run this place, right? There's this deranged group of billionaire people who, you know, and Famke Janssen is the matriarch of this whole group. And they run the whole place. And, you know, once a year they go out and they kill people publicly in like the town square to make a point. And it's become this thing that's like sort of celebrated, but there's no real sense of scale because this movie is intermittently very cheap looking and very cheaply made. At the same time, looks kind of expensive. It's a weird mix of chintzy and cheap looking and also well done, but also not well done. Some of the special effects are great. Some of them are horrible. And some of like the basic special effects, there's a character who gets a knife or an axe in the head, the front of the head. And the tracking for the wound is completely jittery and moving all over the forehead at the kill shot. I couldn't believe it. So a lot of people are, okay, this is a sort of movie that you have to be in the mood for. You've got to be in the mood for this sort of film. And you have to be on its wavelength. It has to hit you either at the right age, the right time, the right mindset, or you have to have the right personality. Because if you don't, you are going to find it like not nails on the chalkboard. You are going to find it excruciatingly painful to sit through this because it is so kind of smug and plucky at the same time. It is so self-assured and self-confident in its own quirkiness and cleverness as it just layers pastiche upon pastiche and homage upon homage. It's partly One Piece. It's partly Naruto. It's partly manga. It's partly anime. It's partly a beat-em-up game. And this is a little stickler for me. So this girl and her brother, Bill Skarsgård and the little girl, are these are all of his memories or whatever. We meet them when they're little kids. Before they're executed, and Skarsgård's character, Boy, survives, they go to the arcade and they play arcade games. And there is this Street Fighter II Champions Edition stand-in that's there. And they love to play that game. It's like Ultra Punch Fighter 2000 or something. You know, it's like some name that no video game ever would have had. It always fucking bothers me when movies do that, because like come up with a credible name instead of like this cheeky sort of name that is a reference to games that didn't exist. That game, so there aren't narrators in tournament games like Mortal Kombat or Killer Instinct or Street Fighter. The most you get is like flawless victory, right? Like fatality, outstanding, like that sort of stuff. Round one, fight. Like that's it. Right? You know, that's it. Perfect. That's all it is. There is no ongoing narration in those games. And in a beat-em-up game, other than the attraction screen, which is probably just going to tell you the name of the game every once in a while, there's no narration at all. And so this movie is actually more akin to a beat-em-up. And I think I'm extra perturbed about this movie because I've had an idea for, I don't know, 20 years to probably longer than that at this point, 25, whatever, to adapt a beat-em-up into an action movie. You know, two people have to go fight their way through a city to get to the high rise to say, and whether it would be Final Fight or Fatal Fury or Streets of Rage or Double Dragon, doesn't really matter. Or its own thing, right? Doesn't really matter. Like these, we got to go from point A to point B all in one night and fight our way very much sort of like Warriors. And now I could say kind of meets John Wick, but I've had this idea since before the Warriors, I should say, before John Wick existed. And the club scene in the first John Wick with all the neon and the lights, the dancing, that convinced me that actually could be done. But now, again, I'm so sick of these sort of movies that I don't even want to see it. So that's why I had high hopes, or some hopes going into this movie and some expectations. The film is annoying and it's extraordinarily inconsistent. And it's throwing everything at the wall. It's not just the gimmick of the Hunger Games or an anime or a beat 'em up that's also pretending to be like a tournament fighter. It is, the main character is psychotic. So Bill Skarsgård, through the trauma and everything he's been through and being constantly introduced to psychoactive drugs, is crazy. And he, commercials come to life for him and he cannot differentiate between reality and hallucinations. And he's hallucinating his dead sister, who is sort of his conscience and his moral guy, but he's ignoring her as he goes, you know, further and further into kind of battle. And it's got the cliche of the ancient Asian mentor figure who spares your life but takes you off into the jungle or wherever to turn you into an instrument of death. And then the white guy comes back and kills everything. And the movie is I fell asleep I dozed off in the first hour, and I think the movie only really gets interesting, if not entirely unexpected, some of these events that happen, highly predictable, but at least significantly more interesting in the last 30 minutes of the movie. And maybe it's a little bit longer than that, but it's really the third act where you go, oh, okay, like maybe this should have been the movie. To do all that sort of stuff where you're pulling from everything that influenced you as a child, you know, arcades and fighting games and anime and manga and cartoons and, you know, Bloodsport and, you know, all these old Jean-Claude Van Damme movies and these martial arts films and superhero shit, like to throw all that together in a blender, it actually takes a really deft hand, which is why Everything Everywhere All at Once, which does that, it's in the title, is such an achievement, because it works, because there's emotional underpinnings. It's not just a bunch of conflicting style elements and wacky off the wall shit just for the sake of being off the wall. And the movie is clever, but it's not smug. And this movie is smug, but it is not clever. This has one of the worst scripts as far as dialogue goes, even by these sorts of movies' standards. And I understand that when this movie premiered, I think maybe last year in some film festivals, Skarsgård originally did the voiceover, and then they had an opportunity to get the guy from Bob's Burgers, who was, I think, from, I originally knew him from like Dr. Katz, MD. He played the son. I'm trying to get what the hell his name is. H. John Benjamin. Yeah. They had an opportunity to get him, and so they recut the movie around his voice. But the problem is, it's just non-fucking stop. It's non-stop, this voice. And there's not a scene that breathes. It explains everything. And the whole thing would have been way more interesting had Skarsgård just been able to Buster Keaton it, and just, he's got these really freakish big golem eyes and this really expressive face. And most of the time he's just expressing things non-verbally. Just like, do that. And if you want to sprinkle in a narrator, or you want to sprinkle in this interior voice, that's fine, I guess. But it's so unnecessary. And the movie drops it. The movie basically drops it for the last 20, 30 minutes. I found myself enjoying it so much more. And that's why. It's largely because this really awful narration is taken out of it. I appreciate this movie for kind of swinging for the fences. And it very much reminds me of like a cult movie. And I don't think it was going for that status. Like, Lisa Frankenstein's a movie that I feel like it's like they were trying to make a cult movie, and it doesn't really work. But between like Abigail, even Night Swim, which I didn't like, Lisa Frankenstein, this movie, a couple more, I feel like it's gonna be different, because we're not limited to cable and linear television watching to see movies and stuff anymore. So I'm interested if this is going to be the case. But these oddball movies feel very akin to the sort of oddball movies that we would get in the 80s that now you look back on and you go, wait a minute, you know, this isn't true, but it's like Adventures in Space Hunter came out the same day as Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom. Like, I know that's not right, the years are off, but it's like, you're looking at the list of movies that came out in the 80s, and you're going, oh, what the hell is that? Oh, that's a really, I didn't even know they made that movie, or that guy was in that movie, or there's all of this experimentation going on. I think between the superhero genre basically falling flat on its face, the major franchises that we've been counting on at the box office have been mostly delivering to varying degrees on television. So Star Wars now is primarily a television property. The MCU is primarily a television property. I'm sure they're going to get back in the theatrical game. I know that they are. But those are the sort of giant tentpole franchises that have been sort of holding down the last remnants of the box office. We don't have any right now. And so there's all of these really odd, off-kilter, sort of creative, if not successful, movies that are coming out. And I think that a lot of them do have the potential. We'll have to see what does a cult movie look like in 2030 as opposed to, you know, 2000, it was a very different place, because now almost everything gets talked about and almost nothing flies under the radar. And the stuff that's under the radar is just really under the radar and typically disappears. You know, there's a lot of mid to lower budgeted films that are going straight to VOD, regardless of who's starring in them, regardless of how good they are or how or not. That unless they're landing on a specialty service like a Shudder, I don't think people are watching them. And even then, it's such a niche audience that has that app. So I'm not sure what cult movies are going to be like, but I think some of these have real potential to become that. And I think if I had seen Boy Kills World, you know, at 12 years old and caught half of it on Cinemax at like 11 p.m. on a Friday night, I might think it ruled. But I will also argue this point. This is a movie that needs to be on shot on film because it's kind of too bright and clean and phony looking. It needs to have grain to it. It needs to have texture to it. It needs to be dirtier. It needs to be, you know, I don't know, it's not grindhouse, but it needs to be, it needs to have grit to it. If it's, you know, and it does it. It has no grit whatsoever. And way too fucking much digital blood splatter. I hate digital blood splatter and digital gunfire, especially when most of the movie is just going to be hails of bullets. So the movie didn't work for me at all. I would not recommend it. I know I'm in the minority. I think the thing's got like a 70-something percent, 80% approval rating. I'm going to add this to my worst of the year list this so far. It might not make it to the end of the year. You know, by the time we get to 2025, it may have fallen off the list, but so far, this is one of the worst movies I've seen this year. If I had to give it a Letterboxd score, I don't know, 1.5, 2 seems fair. Didn't really care for it. All right, now our final film, Challengers. Challengers is the latest Luca, oh my gosh, my brain. My brains. Let's see, I even get the Luca part right. Yes. Luca Guadagnino. Guadagnino. It's produced and starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, Mike Faced, Haley Gates, a few other people in here. It's basically those three people. It's basically Michael Faced, John O'Connor. I'm not even saying Face right. Fast, Faced, Zendaya. It's mostly about those three people and their relationship. It's told in a non-synchronous way. And so we're bumping forward and backwards through time. Essentially during the course of a rivalry match at a qualifying tournament in New Rochelle, for two pros, Zendaya, is the coach of one of the pros. I'm trying to avoid spoilers here. And the other is, the former partner of who she coaches. They played doubles and they went to a like tennis training school together, like a boarding school for tennis players. And they grew up together. And they're friends, rivals, friendly rivals, enemies, all different things throughout the course of time. There's a profound tension underneath between them, and perhaps even a sexual tension between them. And this is something that Zendaya. Zendaya is essentially like a Venus Williams, young, on the come up, late high school, already has like Adidas campaigns. She's essentially going to be the future of women's tennis. And this is in the trailer, so this isn't a spoiler. Something happens throughout the course of her career where she is injured and just cannot she injures her knee and she can't rehabilitate it. She can't be 100%. So if she's not going to be 100%, then she wants to be more or less, this goes unsaid, but she more or less wants to be then like the best coach in tennis. And the three of them are all high-functioning sociopaths, high-functioning narcissists. I don't know the right word for it. They are athletes. They are cutting edge athletes. One of them ends up flaming out. One of them ends up being, you know, a sponsored pro in luxury vehicle ads and is competing in the opens and winning opens and is trying to get their grand slam. And then Zendaya is sort of a Lady Macbeth figure, Tiger Woods dad sort of figure, very controlling, very obsessive, seemingly indifferent to human emotion or ethics. And it is just the story of their relationships and the ever-evolving relationships. If I was an idiot, I would just say, just like a tennis ball volleys from player to player, and the point is to get, they don't say this word, but the point of true tennis is to get a long synchronous volley going between the players, and creates this relationship rhythm. And Zendaya does sort of say this, that it's real tennis, you know, when there are those seconds, those moments where the players almost disappear, and there's, you know, this sort of sexual, hypnotic, rhythmic thrusting of the ball and the grunting and the all this other sort of stuff. And even the players themselves go into this kind of the zone and they cease to exist. And it's like when the game is in its purest. And so there, you know, there's that sort of idea that's in the movie. And I could say that this is that tennis is a metaphor for love, lust, affection, sexuality. Who do we love? Why do we love them? Do we love? Do we use? When are you using people? When are you loving them? When are you using people? When are you pushing them? All these sorts of things. And after a little while, as you're watching the movie, you start to think, okay, what's the thematic point of this film? And it gets there, and it ends, sort of punches the button and goes, okay, this is the point of what you just watched. And it dishes it out fairly consistently. I think what does this movie so many favors, the cast is great, the cast is excellent, is the direction and cinematography. This is one of the most robustly blocked, directed, well thought out, visually interesting, at times kind of visually gimmicky almost, but it's the exact opposite of Boy Kills World, where instead of having all of this shit in here because you can do it, it's like, I think that'd be cool. And rather than trying to put like 10 pounds of cool in a 5-pound bag, so it ends up turning to shit, you are appropriately muscular in your direction and appropriately energetic in the editing and composition. It's a masterfully made film. There's some extraordinarily strange stylistic choices that I don't know entirely work in and of themselves as individual elements. But when you take the totality of the movie and the fact that it is such a thrusting forward, no pun intended, forward, even though we're moving backwards and forwards in time from past and present and slightly less past and slightly more present, even though we're all over the place, you really do have a sense of time, place, both spoken and unspoken. There is written text to help you if you're like, okay, this is 8 months ago or eight years ago, this tournament, whatever. I'm somebody who knows nothing about tennis. I don't know how the point system works. I don't understand what any of that means. I don't know what sets are. I don't know what games are. I don't know what matches are. I don't know how I look at the numbers on the screen and then they're like, quadruple that in the point box. I don't even know if I'm looking at a point box. I don't know, fuck all. And it didn't impede my ability to be absorbed by this movie because the direction so overwhelms you and the performances are so solid and the character decisions are so interesting. It is at times comedic. I would even say at times it dips its toe into absurdism. I'm not even sure it knows that it's doing that. It very much feels like risky business. It's extraordinarily stylistic. It's very, feels very 80s at times, even though it's set from essentially 2006 to 2019 is sort of the range. So that 13-year period back and forth. Sometimes it feels like a 90s European thriller. It feels modern in some ways, but feels very much like a throwback other ways, but it does not feel like an homage to anything else. Now, I will say this. People have labeled this is the horniest movie. there is an extreme amount of homoeroticism. Okay. If homoeroticism turns you on between two men, and I no critique there, I'm just saying, then yeah, this is an extremely sexual movie. Because it's really interrogating kind of these three characters and their relationships, but big chunk of it, especially at the beginning, is this sort of, you know, it's laying bare the sort of subconscious homoeroticism of male competition and literally dick measuring contest, right? It's like, you know, there's something, there's a thin line between that rivalry energy and, like, it's almost like the joke of like, why don't you guys just kiss and get it over with, right? You know what I mean? It's like, it's sort of that. And so again, you could look at this movie and say it's kind of dumb for what it's trying to say, right? The relationships are like a ball, or Zendaya is like this ball that these two guys are competing over and they're hitting her back and forth, or they're the ball, their lives, their affection, and she's the one who's in control. She's the one swinging the racket, because there's a lot of machinations that go on, an indifference to either one of these guys and their suffering. But is there an indifference? Does she care about them? Which one does she care about them? Which one does she care about? Does she care about both of them? Does she care about both of them the same way? All this stuff is subtext. And you could say, you know, the sexuality, the undergirdings of sexuality and aggressiveness and male competition. There's obviously subtext about the grunting and groaning and of how it's quasi-sexual for tennis, especially, and female winning victory screaming is like a female orgasm. And it never puts its finger on the scale, because if it did, it'd be fucking stupid. So at the very least, the script, the director, and the character, the actors know enough to know we can't tip our hand and be like, yeah, tennis is like fucking, like, you know what I mean? Like, the moment you explain the metaphor, it's stupid. It's more about, I don't know, it's about vibes, but it's more about creating a mood. It's more about creating a hot, sweaty competition, rivalry, testosterone, hormonal-driven sexual thing. Zendaya is in her underwear quite a bit, but if you're looking for nudity from the girl from Euphoria, you'll have to look elsewhere. Something that blew me away is because she's in these tennis shorts and these little booty shorts and tennis skirts, I never noticed how long her legs are. And for some reason, I always thought she was like short. She's 5'10". Do they make her? Because our boy, Peter Parker, Tom Holland, he's 5'7" if he's 4'11". Like, he's gonna be standing in apple crates when he's around her, right? Is she taller than him in the movies? She's significantly taller than him. She's 5'10". She isn't like massive, but it's pretty tall for, you know, it's above average for most women. Yeah, so I was just sort of marveling at, like, man. Have her legs always been that long? I didn't notice it. Is Timothy Chalamet like 6'5"? Like, I didn't notice it in Dune 2. I haven't noticed it in anything I've ever seen her in. She's great in this, by the way. There's a little... There is... How do I say this right? The trailers betrayed this movie to some extent. If you're expecting a profound erotic thriller that's, you know, heavy on nudity, it's mostly male nudity, if any, I think that's it, you're not going to get that. And if you want, like, sex scenes, you're not going to get that. It's more tension. It's more sexual, like, the lead up to and the tension throughout the film than it is. Some people are saying, oh, this is the horniest movie. It's so hot. It's so right. I just think we're starved for sex as a society and as moviegoers, because there's less sex in this than in Disclosure, right? If you want to see some fucking in a movie, fire up any movie Michael Douglas made between 1988 and 1994. You'll find it there. Yeah, so Beef Boy ass is rocking. Some dongs are hanging. Some hogs are out. It's great. But yeah, I didn't find this to be, this wasn't sitting in the audience getting all bricked up over this one. This wasn't This wasn't one of those movies where it's like, boy, it's so sexual. It was, to me, it was more psychologically interesting and engaging. Yeah. So, and Zendaya is maybe a tad too young for the role she's playing, not in the past, but in the current day. Like, I believe her in 2016. I don't believe, because she's so young looking, I don't quite believe the age-wise she'd be where she is. But I will give an exception to this. The exception being that she's such a driven person that I could see her sort of, if she's going to be a coach, you know, really getting in there and being getting to a top level very early in her career, very young, because she's that driven. She's that obsessive. So, you know, she's, you know, trying to be the best. So maybe I could buy that, but I don't believe she's aged 13 years. The guys, I do. I'm like, oh, I really believe that we're seeing these guys at different points in their life. I don't know why I believe one, not the other. I'm not exactly sure. If I had to give this is one of the best movies I've seen this year. I really enjoyed all of it. At last 20 minutes, I don't know, 20 minutes, to, there was a moment that it felt like it was getting a little long in the tooth. And right around that time, the movie started wrapping up. And it hooked me back in. So for the direction, for the creative, for the visualization, for the performances alone, even if you don't like tennis, even if you end up thinking it's kind of absurd, the two ladies behind me were laughing. Even if you find it to be absurd, I think this is still an interesting, enjoyable film. I would put this probably at like a 4. It's not quite 4.5 for me. I'm going to give it 4 stars, the old Letterboxd scale. I would say go check it out. I see you get 2 films, Infested on Letterboxd, Shudder. You should definitely go check that out. Check that out on Shudder if you have it. I don't think I rated that one. That one's hard to rate. I give it 3.5 stars, but that's a very solid 3.5 stars for me. Yeah, let's just say 3.5 for that. Boy Kills World, 2 stars, skip it. And Challengers, go see it on a hot, sweaty night. And or hot, sweaty day, 85 degrees outside. Speaking of 85, it's currently 84 degrees here in the last shop, last video store in the universe. So I'm dying. No extended cut this time for the patrons, but you did get this one early, several days early. I couldn't do it without you. If you haven't already, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. It really does help out the show. Please leave us a 5-star review. Somebody else did recently. Thank you to that person who did, if you're listening. We need dozens more. So if you haven't already and you enjoy the show, enjoy what we do here, please leave us a 5-star review. Get us back in the charts in the good old US of A. Till next time, binge on.